This is The Conversation. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. The website for The Conversation is, drumroll please, theconversationpod.com. It's a newly revamped website of The Conversation. If you haven't seen it, go check it out. I think you're going to like the redesign. And we emphasize a little bit more than we did. Don't Call Us, a feature that invites you to participate in the podcast with your stories. A little light on response in that regard. There are a couple samples there to give you a sense of what those entail and what those are like. So if you'd like to contribute, we'd really love to have you. Our guest today on the podcast is art advisor Lisa Schiff of Schiff Fine Art in New York. She works with some very big collectors, I would imagine. We didn't get into the details, but yeah, she has a big hand in the art advisor world for sure, and you'll hear a lot about that. I have to say, I was apprehensive going into our conversation, if only because in doing our initial phone call to explain the show and ask what kind of questions she might have and whatnot, get a sense of each other. That lasted all of about four and a half minutes, so I didn't have much to go on. I didn't know if we were going to hit any kind of wall, based on what she thought the conversation might be like, and and of course I have my idea of what it's going to be like. But in fact, it went splendidly. She was spot on in terms of communicating, having a conversation, explaining what. Not only what goes on as with an art advisor and the art market and so on. I'm going on too long before you've actually heard it, so you get the idea. I'm happy. I'm proud of this episode, and I think you will find it fascinating. Before we get to that, I just want to let you know I'm recording on the last day of 2014, so you must be listening in what, 2016? No, most of the listens do come in the first couple weeks, thanks to you regulars. I appreciate you guys a lot. But the long tail continues, and so this will build over 6 to 9 weeks, and then it'll continue to gain listeners as time goes on. I think this one's going to have a long life. So start spreading the word now. Let's just get those people listening now rather than later, sooner rather than later, eh? I have some important news that I want to share with you about the show and iTunes on the back end, so please stay tuned for that. Let's get to that conversation with Lisa now. I look forward to knowing what you think of it. Without further ado, here we go. Talk to you in the back end. I have Lisa Schiff on the line with me in New York City. Hello.
Hi.
So let me start by getting you to help me clarify your, not only what you do, but what your title is. Would you call yourself an art consultant, an art advisor? Are those two things important distinctions?
I always say art advisor, and I think they're pretty much exactly the same thing, but advisor feels a little bit nicer to me than consultant. I'm not sure why, but
I can help you with that, because I think art consultant can be a pretty broad term, and I think a lot of art consultants are the type of people that we might associate with supplying work for dental offices and hospitals and things like that. Is that about
and
right?
People don't like us. Yeah, people like to not like us. So
is that
I
right?
Try to make it as likable as possible.
That's an interesting story that we'll have to get into. So tell me how would you describe what you do specifically as an art advisor?
I think we help people sift through the mass amount of information coming their way, the mass amount of personalities and players, and we try to help people build a really solid art collection based off their own aesthetic preferences.
Mm-hmm.
So, we try not to build the same collection over and over again based on our aesthetic preferences.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense,
because
it's
does.
A really easy trope to fall into.
Right.
As an advisor.
And when you say people, do you mean collectors and also other people, or who do you mean as well, potentially?
Well, we start off with people who aren't collectors, and we like to help them become collectors.
You make them collectors.
We're good with newbies, yes.
Huh. And I take it, would many of those newbies come from friends of collectors?
Yeah, it's kind of word of mouth.
Yeah.
At this point, in the beginning, it was like friends of family.
Right.
Friends of friends, you know, people throwing me a bone desperately.
Right, right.
But now it's, you know, I've been in over 10 years, so we sort of get a lot of clients coming our way from various
right.
places.
Right. And so the way that you've built up those that reputation and that sort of the momentum and the interest has been, I take it, through a combination of applying the right personality and soft hands, as well as assuring them of your working in their best interests for their aesthetic.
Yeah, I mean, trust and transparency, like, number one. If you can establish that, then, I mean, we have had the same clients since we opened over and 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But we've built up like a ton of trust and transparency. I mean, the art world's so inherently shady just by the nature of simply valuing aesthetics to begin with. So I think that's one of the reasons people even hire an advisor, to help them to learn. Like, you know, you're walking in the dark. So we're like a nightlight.
Right,
you know?
Right.
The whole point of it really is to establish that. And if you don't do that, then forget it.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting to hear you use the word transparency. What forms does that transparency take?
I think what we try to do is explain every single part of the transaction. So let's just say we're buying something on the secondary market.
Mm-hmm.
We disclose who we're buying it from. Is it an individual? Is it a dealer? Is it a gallery? And we disclose our commission and their commission.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's number one.
Just okay.
Because if you're in the know in the art world, it's really easy to just be like, you know, I have this on secondary market, but I'm not telling you. It's my source, you know, and so you don't tell your source.
Right.
We tell our sources. We show everything. We show the email train. I just feel like it helps people wrap their head around the numbers and not feel, you know, you can pull that game for a few rounds, but after, like, with someone new to the game, but after a while, you know, you can't do that. You just can't.
Got it.
It's just going to come back to bite you. And if you can help people, I think one of the biggest fears for people entering the art world, or even people who are already in it, is that where does the price come from? Especially like big finance people. You know,
yeah.
We have a lot of finance clients and they're super skeptical because pricing for artwork isn't really rational. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's not like quantifiable.
Right.
And so we try to, you know, it is on some level, but we explain the collision course of forces that come together to establish a price.
Mm-hmm.
We help people learn how to use ArtNet. We disclose our private catalog of offers that we've had for the last 10 years so that we have, you know, we have our private ArtNet in-house, and then we have ArtNet, and then we have, you know, whatever else we can come up with. We really just show all the cards.
Right. Got it.
And that just makes people feel comfortable. Then they can learn. We want to teach them how to price things.
Yeah.
So that they feel comfortable with it too.
Got it. You mentioned ArtNet, which of course is, you know, I think pretty sort of the go-to place for, you know, looking at auction records and whatnot. But what about,
yep.
I can't remember the name of the site, but something to the effect of buy, sell, holds. Do you use that site at all? Or is that a little
too... That is a joke.
Yeah.
Please don't even say that out loud. That's just no.
Okay. Well, here's another
But
sort
that's
of...
interesting that you bring that up, because that's somebody developing an algorithm.
Right.
And I'm not going to lie. I mean, I'm really interested in all of what the internet and the computer and the digital world will bring to the future of the art world. I think it's fascinating. The potential is there. And just like there are algorithms being developed to help decide what's going to make a hit music song.
Yeah.
I'm sure like people are actually taking it seriously, but I honestly find it's almost impossible to develop a mathematical formula for this.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
But who knows? What do I know?
I hope you're right. I think that's good that there's an unpredictability that algorithms, as I'm sure you are well aware, has become kind of a buzzword for artists too, because a lot of painters and installation, whatever, mixed media artists are applying algorithms to their work. I'm sure you've seen that as a trend of sorts. So speaking of shady things, I can't help but also ask you about the collector roundtables or these sort of collector stamp approving groups that I'm sure you are privy to on one level or another. Is that something you're familiar with? And,
what do you mean?
Okay, well, apparently there are groups of collectors that get together, and as a group, they have a consensus on what artists they're going to buy, and then so it's basically market manipulation that they're engaging in. Something that I've heard about, not firsthand, definitely second or third hand, but I was wondering if you've heard about that as well.
No, but I mean, consensus building in the art world is. I mean, it depends on how big those circles are. And I mean, in a weird way, it doesn't matter on some level. I mean, look at Charles Saatchi. Remember, he used to buy something and he would move the market.
Right.
Now he doesn't move. Like, there's so many private museums and private collectors that have, like, major kind of influence that it almost doesn't matter anymore. I mean, it would have to be a pretty massive group, but if you're talking about Peter Brandt and the Mughrabis getting together, I mean, you can see what their consensus is anyways, so it doesn't matter. I can have that kind of authority by getting behind a certain artist, and that person over there can do it, you know. So there's too many people doing that.
Right.
Too many curators, too many museum trustees, that one little group isn't going to affect the market.
Okay. But speaking of deciding, that you're really passionate about a particular artist, would you consider it, are there circumstances where that would be ethical or unethical that you would do that? I mean, and I'll preface that by saying, based on what you said about transparency and the people that you work with, that wouldn't really be part of your MO because it's about building their collections, not, about you being a tastemaker.
Yeah, but it's not something I would do intentionally, just by virtue of I get excited about an artist and start to become active with an artist. And I'm just using this as a hypothetical, but I think it's probably already happened, that it just becomes like an energy in the world. Right. If I'm working with enough people and I'm buying enough of the work, it just becomes a thing out there that a certain person's really interested in that work, and you can start to feel the market heating up a little bit. I wouldn't say move, but like when there's a lot of attention on something, it starts to percolate. And that could be me and like 10 other people at the same time.
Right.
So that's why some intentional group like that, it's significant but insignificant. The only way you can really manipulate the market is if you start playing the auction houses.
Right.
So
right.
Just by virtue of green stamping something, I don't really feel like that is going to have a huge impact long term. Where I think you can really be surreptitious is at auction, because you can buy 10 of something with your friends, throw one up for auction, buy it back at a high price, and move the market. That's shady.
Right.
And I'm pretty sure it happens often.
Would you say it's shady even to use the expression, I'm bullish about so-and-so artist?
No.
Okay. Do you say that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Well, I mean, the reason that surprises me is because...
Why would it be bad to say I'm bullish about an artist? That just means for me, I'm really excited about this artist.
Well, because you're the way you're framing it is through a financial lens.
I don't think so. It's just like, I mean,
you're using it just in a vernacular way.
If I'm working with clients, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they want to know what I think about an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I love this artist. That's the same thing as me saying I'm bullish about this artist. I'm just, for me, that means I'm really behind this artist. So, of course, that's why they're paying me. They want to know what artists I really believe in.
Right.
And that doesn't have to have anything to do with finance for me.
Okay. So in other words, my devil's advocate might be getting too bogged down in the the language of bullish when in this case, it's really just vernacular for I'm really passionate.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean,
behind.
It doesn't mean I'm buying and selling it privately.
Right.
I don't do that. It
right.
just means I'm really behind this artist, and if I have clients who like it, I'm going to say, yes, you should really buy this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, I'm doing the same thing your collector group is doing. I actually don't even find that even remotely interesting. I think what you really have to focus on are the auction manipulations. Getting together and saying we're approving this is, that's just consensus building, which happens in museum boardrooms every day.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, it really depends on the nature of the consensus building. Like, in a weird way, there are, in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, multiple sectors of the art market now. Because for us, we have two criteria. We have, it has to be visually and conceptually compelling, and it has to have historical relevance. If it has those two things, then we feel confident in the market for it, right? We're
mm-hmm.
not just like isolating the market. And I only bring that up because it's not like our clients are saying, is this an investment? Like, we're not working with people who need to make money off of art. But you want to be able to, if you're spending, I mean, art is really expensive now. It was not this expensive 10 years ago, 20 years ago. It's tons of money out of the gate. So you just want to be able to show people that their overall portfolio looks good, period. Their asset allocation is happy.
Right.
And, you know, even when people tell us they don't care, we care for them because in a year, they're going to care. They always do. And again, it's not about reselling. It's just that, you know, if you're going to go spend $100,000 on something, then you need to know if when you're walking out the door, it's possibly going to have no value. And I find it to be, like, naive and hypocritical not to consider those things
sure.
as important.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. When you say there's a lot of money out the door, you know, when you're talking about how expensive things are, certainly that's the case as much now as ever. But we should clarify that refers to blue chip art, because from my limited vantage point, it seems that, you know, emerging non blue chip or even non, you know, gallery represented art is no more expensive than it was 10 years ago.
I don't think so. I think emerging art is way more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think you're talking like $500 to $1,000 10 to 20 years ago.
Okay. And now?
Now I feel like you're talking like 5 to 20.
Wow. Hmm.
But I could be looking at different artists.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think the another way to maybe put it, and we don't have to get too bogged down in this, but I think that is sort of creeping into the blue chip range. You know what I mean? It may be at the young end of the blue chip range, but it's still one. It's like you're
blue
either
chip cannot be young emerging. It just isn't.
Well, but if it's $20,000, I can't imagine that fits into, you know, a sort of unknown / emerging category.
That is an unknown emerging category. I promise you. I mean,
do you want to give me an? Do you want to give
maybe
us
like a year of exhibitions under your belt, but like super hot?
Uh huh.
For 20 grand, you know, I actually can't think of anything off the top of my head, but maybe I'll think of something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine. Okay.
Fair
enough.
I think, you know, contemporary art used to be very inexpensive. It used to be all about modern impressionism. That was your blue chip.
Right.
You know, now we consider someone with a year's worth of exhibitions to be blue chip. That's really something, you know?
That's a little crazy. Yeah, yeah. Well, we're talking the day after the 2014 Miami Art Fairs Art Basel and all its satellites ended, and you were down there. Were you down there for the whole thing? Were you down there for the heart of it at the beginning? When were you there?
I went down Tuesday morning and I came back Saturday morning.
Okay, so you were there for most of it, including all the pre.
Events, right? Typically, I would go Sunday to Sunday, but I have a 2-year-old son, a single mom. So
wow, that's fascinating.
I can't leave so much.
Did you leave your son at home while you went?
Yeah, I left my son, but I had my whole staff down there Sunday to Sunday.
Wow, okay. And you don't have a booth actually. You are there.
No. We Miami is a really hard fair for us because it's Miami and it's sunny and it's in the U.S., every single collector we work with wants to go to that fair. And as an advisor, that's like a nightmare situation because you always want every collector you work with to feel like they're the only collector you work with.
Right.
It's absolutely impossible at an art fair like that.
Right. So it's a logistical nightmare.
A nightmare. And I always feel nauseous the whole time.
Oh, wow.
I never enjoy it.
Well, that's really heartening, actually, and I don't know if you know why I think that, because I think for most outsiders, you know, or just people who haven't been integrated into the Miami system, they would think that, you know, high-end art advisors and Miami, it's like a match made in heaven, because this is like where you are going to do a huge percentage of your business for the year. And, you know, and it's not, I guess, maybe the thought of whether you love that or not is not going to come into play. But I mean, those are the kind of my biases going in. But the fact that now that you've sort of clarified what's going on, that, you know, that this is a time to sort of both, spotlight and educate, you know, your favorite clients, but at the same time, your attention is going to be all over the place, and inevitably some of those clients are going to feel, you know.
Oh, they're pissed. The gallery's pissed. You know, actually, it's funny you say that. For us at Miami, we go in, and this is the talk we have with the staff, is our job in Miami is to say no, not yes. Because in a bull market like we're in right now, in a place like Miami, which feels like Las Vegas, that's where people make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been in it long enough. I can promise you my first few years of doing Miami, I was happier than a pig in shit. I was like, wow, I just made a lot of money. But all of that comes back to bite you in the end.
Interesting. How so?
Because people are caught up in the moment. And when you're standing in front of a booth with someone, you can't have this whole conversation about why this doesn't fit the collection or why maybe we should wait and look at this or look at that. And so people will buy impulsively, and then we feel responsible later on.
Right.
So, and actually, I feel like all of our clients were really, everyone was really conservative at this fair. Actually, it was one of the best fairs I've had in a long time. I don't know why, but everybody really bought smart things, like smart and not hyped. It was actually really fun. Those sales are really fun.
Mm-hmm.
The hyped ones were fun in the beginning. They're not fun anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's always a disaster, I feel like.
How so?
Because I don't feel like those artists tend to last. If they do, I prefer to buy them off the fair zone. And that's the other thing. Like, we have such good relationships with the galleries that, like, a lot of times there's an artist that people are going nuts for. And I will just say, let's just work on this after the fair. Because we know each other. They know my clients. We don't have to get the one on the booth. You know, we can wait and get one next month.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's more coming.
Right.
But they're under so much pressure at a fair by people who they don't see as much as they see me to give them something special. And I think, like, most of our clients are really cool about it, too. None of them are like, I have to have it now. So I should say I feel really lucky because I feel like we work with really nice people.
Mm.
You know, not like not glitzy people. We don't work with the glamour crowd. Mm-hmm. We work with people who are kind of off the, like, nobody wants to go to the gallery parties.
Right.
They just want to have a quiet dinner and talk about what they saw. And, you know, we have fun together, but they don't want to do the big party circuit.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel really, really good about that. But I think, you know, in the beginning, yeah, I tried to get the one thing off the booth. That was the hardest thing to get because I felt like I had to try to do that for someone. And now if there's somebody who's interested in that, I just say, let's just wait till after the fair because it's too much of a battle.
Right. And so it sounds like you're spending a lot of time with these lower key collectors. For this fair, for example, did you not go to the evening events or did you go to some of them?
Not a single one.
Wow.
We had our own dinners every night, which were actually really nice. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were pretty big dinners. They were like 15 to 20 people.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had one gallery throw us our own dinner, just my clients.
What gallery? You don't mind my asking?
Lorraine Augustine.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really nice. It was really nice. I mean, I RSVP'd for Jeffrey Deitch, Miley Cyrus, and I RSVP'd for W. And, like, on some level, I would love to go, but I'm tired. I have to work in the morning, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know. None of our clients are really... I think we, like, we RSVP'd for a few people. But everybody's... We, like, hung out with each other. It was nice.
When was that dinner that you were referring to? What night was that, just out of curiosity?
Which one, Lorraine Augustine?
Yeah.
Thursday.
Okay. The reason I ask is because I had a conversation with an artist who was at the fair, and before the fair we spoke, and he talked about his running into Sarah Larson, you know, the writer of the Inside Art World books. And
oh, yeah.
They were talking about, you know, thus and so events and parties and whatever, and she was saying... Yeah, she said to him, yeah, those already happened. Those are, you know, those happen like the first couple of nights. And those are the kinds of parties that are really sort of exclusive, I guess. And
I'm sure there were plenty that I was not invited to.
Really? So you're writing yourself as not being part of that inside backdoor kind of scene. But it sounds like you kind of are as well.
I mean, not all of them. I mean, I got invited to some of them, but I wasn't invited to Gagosian's dinner, and I'm sure they had a fancy one. But if I wanted to be, I could ask to be.
Right.
But I don't really, it doesn't do anything for me. You know, it doesn't, you know, it really isn't. I feel like the time I might spend with my client from Gagosian, or sorry, my contact from Gagosian at the gallery or on the phone or working on stuff specifically is more important to me than showing up at the dinner. I don't really think it matters that much. And if it, I mean, it's, you know, if they were throwing a dinner for Albert Olin, I would be there. You know, it depends on if it's just like an art fair dinner. I mean, they have like more exciting people to invite than me, and I have more important things to work on. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. You're kind of delineating the social status element with the, you know, getting the job done kind of.
I got to get the job done.
Yeah.
I got to pay the bills.
Yeah, right.
We have 6 people working here now and about to be 7.
Wow.
Actually about to be 8.
Wow.
And I've got to make sure I've got to make sure that we're doing a really good job for our clients. Otherwise, we're just, you know, it won't work.
I guess, you know, again, from sort of a, you know, somebody who's very unfamiliar with the world or quite unfamiliar with the world, it sounds like you're saying that, or what you're implying is that maybe those kinds of events are good for people who are up and coming and they're going to make contacts there that could make a big difference in their business. But when you, somebody like you who already has, you know, a full roster of clients that they're working with, it's more about maintaining those clients than it is about, you know, being flashy and, you know,
Yeah,
and being available.
Look, we're always happy to make new clients, but I certainly don't plan on meeting that person at an art fair party.
Right. I see. Interesting. Okay.
Because I don't want to. I don't want flashy clients. You know, I really don't. I want serious clients.
Yeah. Well, is it, well, since we did mention Gagosian, who, you know, which is always a very charged name to bring up in any art-related conversation.
I know.
Would, it's interesting to me, too. Would people at that party or just clients of that gallery in general be considered flashy by nature of that connection or not necessarily?
I think Larry's like a god, and I aspire to be the Larry Gagosian of art advisors. So uh-huh. I think that tells you that I think as much as like I want to hate him, of all the mega galleries, I actually feel like he's coming out on the other end. Now, I think he's doing sales of epic proportions.
Sure.
Well beyond anything I will sell anytime soon, although I aspire to that. I shouldn't say that out loud. But I think, you know, he's just the guy who does the parties that are glitzy. He's got the celebrities, you know, he just has that. It's like, I think probably of all the parties that are thrown in Miami, he does the one. And I've been to them, the dinners that are the most star-studded.
Right.
And I don't think that's a bad thing. You know, I'm not like downplaying that, because there is this whole collapse between art, fashion, and entertainment that's happening. And I feel like Jeffrey Deitch is really leading that charge. Also, like, Jeffrey had two parties in Miami, one of which I was invited to and one of which I wasn't. And the one I wasn't invited to was probably more interesting. It was a little bit more low key.
Yeah.
And I bet you he had really interesting people there, and I would have enjoyed it. So, but no bitterness at all about it, and I probably wouldn't have been able to go anyways. But I do think that Larry Gagosian is doing a damn good job of maintaining his empire. There's lots of problems with it, but of all the mega galleries, I actually think now that he's, you know, it's when he takes on young artists that it's a disaster. But when he takes on estates and does shows with Picasso and de Kooning and Fontana and,
right.
and Zony, I mean, he does a spectacular job.
Right. That's well said. I think I would be remiss if I didn't mention, maybe speaking of shady, going back to one of our original buzzwords, Stephen Cohen, you know, in that connection.
Yeah.
I mean, that's maybe the only name, but I mean, I can't imagine that you would ever want to be associated with that kind of shadiness.
I don't know anything about that. I'm not going to lie. I would love to sell a $250 million Picasso. That's got to be fun.
Right, yeah.
But whatever other shadiness is happening there, I am not privy to it, so...
Mm. Well, if you have any time, not that with a 2-year-old, you're probably not going to, and you're in your business, you're probably not going to have any, but, I do highly recommend some of these recent, New York Times and New Yorker articles.
Will, I should read that.
I'm curious, since we're talking about, just to put a sort of closing point on the sort of celebrity or, you know, fashion entertainment element of Miami, you know, one thing that I couldn't avoid hearing about as much as I tried to sort of keep clear of news from Miami was that, you know, that Tommy Hilfiger buying this hotel and having, you know, one of the other big celebrity parties there. I guess I just want to ask.
Oh, was that the Edition Hotel?
I'm not sure, but, you know, it was the Times did a piece about it, you know, before the fair started. And I guess I just wonder whether you feel like the potential advantage of, you know, including the celebrity element into the scene is that it exposes the art world to, you know, more people. It doesn't seem like there really is any benefit ultimately there, because it may give some people in the art world, you know, page six attention, but it doesn't really feel like that's really going to have any kind of serious impact.
No, I don't think it's about that at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly, I don't think celebrities make great art collectors for the most part, and mm-hmm. That's a huge generalization, but generally speaking, they're the really good actors are artists themselves, and they are way immersed in that. It's like the tech guys. Everybody's trying to chase the Silicon Valley guys to be collectors because they are the Rockefellers of today.
Right.
But they're mm-hmm. also kind of artists, and I think what's more interesting about this mix between fashion, entertainment, and art is the mere fact that the currency of the future is simply creativity in any form.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been merging, and it's just going to the next degree of merge. I don't know what that means, but I find it really interesting. I mean, it's like everything is about creativity and ideas. And so that's all I can say on that note, but I think something's happening. And Jeffrey Deitch was actually one of the more, I don't know how to pronounce this word, prescient, prescient.
Prescient, sorry. Uh-huh. Sure, that's good.
Prescient. People I know who I think is so incredibly smart, actually. You kind of want to hate him, but you can't.
A lot of people do.
I know, but if you ever hear him speak on like the public realm, or if you look at that show that he curated in 1990, Posthumanism, which was so genius and so relevant today. And now he did this, when he gave a talk in 2006 called Art and Money, it was a roundtable. And he was so smart on that. And he predicted this entertainment sort of arena for art, which he brought to Mocha and didn't work. But he, you know, his street show, which will probably in 20 years be famous, and which I didn't really care for, but it was more the idea of it. But he did a party in Miami with Tommy Hilfiger, V Magazine, featuring Miley Cyrus, which I thought was super hilarious on the one hand and super interesting on the other, simply from this kind of future that we have, which I don't know what the art world will look like in 10 to 20 years. I think it will look vastly different. And I think you just have to be excited about it.
What are you seeing in your crystal ball when you think it'll be vastly different?
I don't know. I don't know if I'll be here. I don't know if I'll just be, you know, remanded to being an algorithm.
right, I see.
I mean, you know, look, I did Artsy asked me to do an editorial on their 9 top trending artists from their website. And I didn't really like a single one of them, but I picked one and wrote about it.
Who did you pick?
I was like, I'll write on one of these, not all 9, because I only like one.
Who did you pick?
But it made me, it was interesting to me that these were trending, and what does that mean? It's like you're telling me about these collectors who are meeting in private. I'm like, no one's going to care about that. They're going to look on Artsy and see who's trending mm-hmm. and buy that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it's like, where does history fall into this? I mean, that's where we've been really, like, careful. This is why to go to bed early, because I feel like, I mean, we can argue philosophically, does history matter anymore and all that other stuff, but what I find super fascinating is for me to try to figure out what are the historical things happening today. And so I really think, you know, the whole digital platform is super interesting. And I mean, this is stupid, and I'm not trying to plug myself here, but since you asked, so we've been curating a show called Open Source Art at the Eclipse of Capitalism. And it's really brought me into the future and into the past. And the future is super interesting in every other sector of the world. I mean, it's changing really, really, really quickly. And I don't see why we're not changing either. I mean, we don't really talk about it in the art world. We're like in this little bubble over here. And
yeah.
I think we had better start thinking about it because it's coming. It's happening already. So I'm just trying to watch those things. Like, you know, what are these things that are happening everywhere? And why wouldn't they happen here? And how is that? What's that going to look like? I don't know. I don't know what the auction houses will look like. I don't know if James Cohan's really disastrous online art fair is actually going to be the future. You know, will we just function in that world a little bit? On the other hand, I think we need both. I don't know.
So I have two questions based on what you just said. One is, it sounds like artsy ultimately is the buy, sell, hold of for people who want to know what's trending, right? I mean, maybe not sell or hold, but certainly buy if they're, you know, if they have this ongoing trending feature.
I don't know if we're going to give them the credit. I think they came up with a really poor business model, but they have some big people behind them, including Larry Gagosian. And I mean, they have tons of money. But what I would say is, think about MySpace.
Okay.
MySpace is gone.
Yeah.
Now there's Facebook. So someone is going to come along and do an upgraded version of Artsy. Maybe Artsy will do an upgraded version of Artsy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking, like, there was Yahoo before Google, and now there's Google. So,
right.
How
important is Artsy to you and your staff?
It isn't at all.
Good. Good. Good answer. And the other question I had is, I'm fascinated by the title of that editorial. Or was it the editorial, or was it something else that you mentioned?
Oh, the show that we're curating.
The show. Well, the eclipse of capitalism. What exactly?
I know, isn't that fun?
What is the eclipse of capitalism? I'm really curious to know what that is.
Well, just to quickly explain, first of all, I get phone calls from reporters like weekly asking to talk about the art market, and I am tired of it.
Good. Can I just interject by saying that I am not a reporter? just to be clear.
I am an economic determinist, and I have always been obsessed with economic history.
Uh-huh.
And I picked up a book called Zero Marginal Cost, The Internet of Things, The Collaborative Commons, and The Eclipse of Capitalism by an economist named Jeremy Rifkin. It's a great read. It has nothing to do with art or culture, but I read it, and I thought, this is so fascinating. And actually, you know, the best art reflects everything that's happening around us all the time. So I thought, you know, we had been looking at all these young artists who keep getting ghettoized and fetishized as, like, post-internet and over in this tech realm. And I thought, they're really reflecting it. But actually, artists... part of the premise of the book is that every industrial revolution, and we are now at the beginning of the third, occurs when there's a collision between advancements in energy and communications. So our current one has to do with the exhaustion of fossil fuel, the advent of renewable energy, and the internet. And so you can kind of, roughly speaking, trace that date to 1990.
Hmm.
So we decided to take a show looking at art from 1990 to the present, and the idea of the eclipse of capitalism is just a hypothetical, that there is a little bit of a collaborative commons happening right now, but will it happen all the way? Probably not in this country. It should, because for a variety of reasons, one of which is that capitalism by its very nature cannot give a shit about the biosphere, and if we do not give a shit about the biosphere, well, then the art world in 20 years won't matter anymore.
Right.
And so I wanted to throw that out there and to take a look at artists working since 1990 who have used new technology and reflected on the ecology and energy, and just kind of frame them in this socioeconomic hypothetical, and just to also irritate people. You know, that's just like 20 people said, you must take that out of the title. And I was like, oh, no, absolutely not. We must keep this in the title, because... Mm-hmm. We don't talk about the economy. Artists talk about it all the time.
Right.
But all we ever talk about is their market.
Right.
And so I thought, let's give them a chance to, like, let's look at this as a thing that's happening that's, like, potentially catastrophic and happening fast.
Do you recommend some of that type of work to your clients?
Oh, well, the artists within the show are fantastic. I mean, we're talking Albert Olin, Pierre Huig, Lauren Calzadilla, Katya Novitskova, Agnieszka Courant, Avery Singer, Corey Archangel, Seth Price, Mark Lecky. It's like every artist I've ever loved is in that show. So, yes.
Okay. Well, what, speaking of types of art, how would you break down, if you had to sort of generalize, the ratio of X type of art to Y type of art to Z type of art that you your clients generally end up buying? I mean, I imagine based on the market, because this is a theme that's been coming up in recent conversations I've been having, it's going to come up in future ones, that there is a pretty heavy weight of abstract painting going on. Is that something that you're finding as well?
Oh yeah, but we're over that now.
You're over it.
We've moved on.
Really? Yeah. What was the peak?
We look at that as, I mean, for me, that was bookended. And now it's just like third, fourth, fifth tier, mediocre process-based abstraction that I'm not interested in, even if it's pretty. But I mean, I still, just to look at Jeffrey Deitch, his Painting Factory show, which was like the most obvious show that anyone could do, for me was a bookend for all of this abstraction, which was great. I mean, there are some abstract painters that we still buy that are really current, but we're really focused on Christopher Wool, Kelly Walker, Wade Guyton, Josh Smith, Seth Price, some of which is not abstract, some of it gets to be figurative. Albert Olin, but then, you know, moving forward, we're looking more. And when I say we, this is generally where I would recommend people to look, but they can look, I mean, we can go in many directions, but I would pretty much dissuade them from looking at a young process-based abstract painter that's just coming out of the gate today. Mm-hmm. If they want it, that's fine. But I would say if you're looking at this, you might want to look at this instead, because again, for me, it's historical. So like there's a moment at which it ends, unless it's bringing something completely different to the table. Like we just bought a Corey Archangel gradient. Corey's a genius, and you know, he's primarily video based. We're doing a lot of video actually.
Wow. Well, yeah. Those artists that you mentioned, just, you know, for listeners who are not, you know, familiar with all those names, that's very expensive work, because those are all, you know, they're either canonized people, about to be canonized, or just super hot people. So that's definitely the kind of thing.
Well,
where...
no, I mean, look, we just bought like a Penty. I'm going to mispronounce his last name. Monikin.
Penty Munkinen?
Yes.
He's a local boy. Yeah. Los Angeles.
We just bought one of his for, you know, 10 grand.
Wow.
Is that still expensive?
No.
No.
Not for your collectors, I would imagine.
No, but you know, so we're looking, like if we're going to look at young right now, I'm going in that direction if I have my jitters. But yes, if somebody is like, okay, I want an abstract painting and I only have 10 grand to spend.
Right.
Then I would really probably think hard about finding somebody who wasn't just a pure painter, but who was doing it sort of somehow in the digital realm.
Right, right.
That's just a guess off the top of my head.
Do you primarily, my sense is that you work with pretty blue chip galleries. To what extent do you either work with emerging or sort of off the beaten track galleries, or even in some rare cases, you know, outside of the gallery system?
No, we totally work with young galleries. Like look at one of my favorite galleries is Kraupe Tuscany Ziedler. They're based in Berlin. They're very tiny. Mm-hmm. And in LA, there's a lot of young new galleries like that. I don't even know that well in Paris
right.
also.
Mm-hmm.
No, my girls keep me up to date with where we're looking. But, you know, look at a gallery like Knight Gallery, which is, like, turning expensive, right? Like, I could name them as a young gallery, but in the nanosecond, they're going to be really expensive.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
The young, like, you know, we do a lot with Robbie Fitzpatrick, Overdone, you know, but these galleries go very quickly from 0 to 100. But, no, we love looking at young stuff. I don't like to buy directly from artist studios. I don't
because
that's
a very dangerous investment, isn't it?
It isn't about that. It's complicated. You know, the future might be different. It's just that, unless I'm really 1,000% sure, I usually like to wait and see what they do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I don't want to just stock up on stuff because it's cheap.
Right. Right.
You know, and someone's like, you know, so I'm not like going to walk in and be like, oh, I'm going to buy your whole studio out because I can. and maybe I'm going to make a ton of money off of you. It's so not my thing. I would so much rather pay $20,000 after they have a couple of shows under the belt and I could see what direction they're going in.
So let's look at that scenario from the other side. If you are considering visiting a young, you know, unrepresented artist studio or not so young unrepresented artist studio, what would their potential benefit be from having you over? I would it in some cases be that you would recommend their work to a gallery? Has that happened?
I think it's more just having me in and getting feedback and, you know.
What is your studio visit style?
We do a lot of studio visits.
Not how many, but what is your style? In other words, what I mean specifically by that is...
why do I do it?
Specifically what your MO is when you're in the studio. Do you ask a lot of questions and kind of sit back? Do you give them, you know, constructive criticism, you know, all of the above?
No, I don't criticize. I tend to do more studios where they don't need my criticism, and I go to learn. I go to understand the back end of things. You know, like I want to know, just because I like something on the gallery wall, I want to really understand what's going on if I'm going to recommend it. And so doing a studio visit, I mean, it's like just to give an example of a recent studio visit where I was just like, I love this man so much, is Corey Archangel. You know, he's so smart and interesting and funny, and he'll take you through his, you know, because what you get to see things like a couple things on a wall, a couple things in a booth, but to like sit with an artist and go through their whole history is amazing.
Right.
You know, and I feel way more on top of it when I do that. If I'm going to a really young, like I went as a favor to somebody recently, and I bought something for myself as a favor, you know, I mean, I liked it, but I don't, you know what I mean? I just did it to be supportive. But I'm not really, I mean, I gave some criticism, but I don't really, I'm not a gallery, you know, I'm not that person.
Sure.
And I think one of the reasons I never wanted to have a gallery is because I'm not that person. I just want to walk in and say, I like that one over there and that one over there. I want to understand everything in the middle, but I don't want to have to be responsible for it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. And I'm actually really glad that you mentioned that, because it was, I think, something I was thinking about before we were going to talk that I had forgotten about, which is, you know, what is the difference between being... Why did you choose to get into art advising as opposed to dealing? And I think you really answered that. And it sounds like, on one hand, you have just a ton more freedom doing that. But I guess at the same time, you don't have some of the securities that a gallery has. Would that be a fair way to put it?
No,
how would you put
it? No, it's more like it's just not my strength. Like a lot of gallerists were former artists. You know, and I went to graduate school. I sat in those critique rooms.
What was your graduate school in?
I am ABD and my PhD in art history.
Oh, okay. So you were doing art history, but as part of that process or at that school, you would go to some critiques.
Yeah, we sat in on the MFA critiques.
Got it.
You know, I'm like a nice person. Like I'm like, I like to make everybody happy, so I'm not comfortable saying this sucks.
Right.
And you should do it this way.
Right.
And B, I don't feel like I think that way. Like the technical, I feel like people who were artists do the best critiques. Not always. Like I have a good friend who has a PhD in art history and she's fantastic at critiquing. It's just not my strength.
Sure.
And so I would hate to even put it out there. Unless it's just so glaringly obvious, and then I'm happy to say it, but like, you know, it's just not, it's not my job, it's not my critique, and a really good gallerist is going to totally be that professor in the MFA class all the way through, teach them how to edit correctly. I don't want to do that job. It's not my thing.
Right.
That's a big job. I think being a gallery is the most difficult job in the world. Because they have to deal with clients and the artists, and the artists are high maintenance.
they can be
demanding, and they have needs, and oh my God, it's like having like a whole flock of kids.
Right.
And so I wouldn't, you know, I really, you know, some of these people are amazing. The women, some of these women who have come through are just like incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. But just to play devil's advocate, since this is was originally an artist podcast, it's not easy being an artist either.
Not everybody can
be Corey Archangel.
Let me back up. The worst job in the world is to be an artist.
Thank you. Well said.
Once you make it, it's okay. But if you're not even getting recognized, and that's where I feel, that's where I really hesitate to help out, because the reason I don't help out is because galleries like to discover artists on their own. And I'm always worried that if I recommend an artist, I'm actually going to hurt them. You know, it's like some art advisor suggested, unless it's like a really close friend. Like there are certain people I've worked with for so long that because they know that I do really well with the young stuff, there's a few people who would listen to me. But I prefer to stay out of it. It's complicated, you know, it's complicated. I endorsed one artist one time, and that gallery actually wanted to work with that artist, and then he chose somebody else. And I was like, I'm not getting involved in this anymore.
Right.
You know, it's...
It's like being
really
a triangulator. Yeah.
Totally. But especially for the really unknown, like, you know, I always recommend to meet, you got to meet, sorry, my dog's going to bark.
That's okay.
Hey, come on in. I always recommend to meet with curators and try to get curated.
Maybe we should wait until you're.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Okay, Fifi. And to try to get picked up by, to get curated into a group show.
Right. I think, what Fifi is your dog's name?
That is, there's a Mr. Owen and a Fiona.
Fiona. Which one are we hearing? Both?
Both.
Okay. Mr. Owen and Fiona, I think they're saying Lisa needs to get back to work.
Yes.
Lisa, this has been very elucidating, and it's been lovely to talk to you.
You too. Thank you so much for including me. I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Okay. And we're out. There you go. Thank you very much again to Lisa Schiff for talking to me, and thank you as well to Abby, also of Schiff Fine Art, who helped set it up and has been very helpful in doing the communique before and since the conversation, including getting the images, which you can find at theconversationpod.com. So the main thing I wanted to tell you about the show that I learned very recently, as far as numbers and traffic and that kind of thing, and I would really appreciate if you could help in this regard, and it's very easy. I found out from a long-time podcaster, it turns out that iTunes is king when it comes to sort of traffic and ratings and, you know, the sort of podcast audience, even if you listen through another device. As it turns out, this woman, this longtime podcaster, informed me and others, you can subscribe to The Conversation and then immediately unsubscribe. And it doesn't matter. iTunes counts it as a subscription and adds that number. So if you have not already subscribed in iTunes, please do so. You can always unsubscribe. Get your friends to do the same. That'll help build the traffic a little bit. It would be truly amazing if we were able to have enough numbers to garner some form of advertising. That would really be amazing. In the meantime, if you would like to support the show financially, it would be greatly appreciated. You can do that via PayPal or other means through the website. Of course, you can also support the show via social media, becoming a fan on Facebook, following on Twitter and Instagram, and you can certainly write to the show if you have any kind of feedback. Of course, Don't Call Us is a way that you can participate in the ongoing dialogue of the show. And happy 2015 to you. What else? I think that's about it. Let us know what you thought of this episode. Provocative, civilized, but potentially provocative. Let me try that again. A civilized but potentially provocative conversation that may raise some of you more idealistic folks' hackles in some way, shape, or form. So do weigh in what you think about anything that was said. And thank you again very much to Lisa Schiff for doing this. You can hear how busy she is. 8 employees now. So Godspeed, Schiff Fine Art. And thank you very much to you for listening, especially you regulars. You are a godsend. Keep listening, keep spreading the word, and Onward and Upward. Talk to you next Saturday. Ciao for now.